A powerful quake hit in the mountains of Afghanistan, where rural villages were severely damaged.
When the earthquake hit in the middle of the night while everyone was sleeping, these houses essentially collapsed on top of one another.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. More about the emergency response in Afghanistan and the trend lines for childhood vaccination in Britain.
The general direction is unfortunately downwards.
The ramifications of that are already becoming clear. Also today, there's another aid flotilla heading toward Gaza.
I think this is not a symbolic gesture.
Then, why Indonesians are taking to the streets in anger.
The political elite have made themselves richer and richer.
Those stories and many more are all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for being with us this Monday. Marco Werman is off this week. Search and rescue operations are ongoing in eastern Afghanistan, where a 6.0 magnitude earthquake hit just before midnight on Sunday. At least 1,400 people were killed, according to Taliban officials, and many more were injured. The World's Shirin Jafari has been speaking with aid workers on the ground to get the latest.
The shock and anguish of the residents in this area in eastern Afghanistan can be heard in the cries of this young boy. The video was captured by local media. The boy raises his hands to the sky, asking God where his family disappeared. Behind him are piles of wood, beams that until a few hours before made up the roofs and walls of these homes. Samira Syed Rahman is in Jalalabad in eastern Afghanistan. She's with Save the Children and has just returned from the affected areas.
It's incredibly mountainous terrain. You have these houses that are built onto the sides of mountains and these narrow valleys in between. And when the earthquake hit in the middle of the night while everyone was sleeping, these houses essentially collapsed on top of one another.
Syed Rahman says many of the roads are still inaccessible. Helicopters have arrived at the scene. They've been evacuating the injured to healthcare centers in other parts of the country. Syed Rahman says some areas are not even accessible with helicopters. And in rescue efforts, time is of the essence.
Children are going hungry, families are forced to sleep in the open, and without clean drinking water, there is a major fear of the spread of diseases and infections amongst those who are left behind in these communities.
Videos posted online showed people digging with their bare hands to find survivors. Obaidullah Bahir teaches at the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul. He says Afghans are in shock and are following the news of the devastation.
A father says he doesn't need money, he doesn't need food. He has his 5 dead children and his wife and his mother and his brother. He says, all I want is the ability to move them out of here so I can lay them to rest and bury them.
Afghanistan was facing many challenges even before this earthquake. Since the U.S. withdrawal in 2021, the government in Kabul has been isolated by most of the international community. The U.S. froze Afghanistan's financial assets after the fall of the previous government. Bahir says this complicates rescue efforts.
For a country that doesn't have access to its national reserves, who have private bank that is operating as a national bank and who has funds flown in by the UN, is obviously going to be in a fragile economic state.
Adding to the Taliban's isolation has been the dwindling of aid going into the country. Afghanistan's economy relied heavily on international aid. Mia Park is with the International Organization for Migration in Kabul.
You know, we have very limited resources now these days in Afghanistan. There's been aid cut. It's been a lot of struggle.
Park adds that in recent months, neighboring countries like Iran and Pakistan have been pushing Afghan refugees back to Afghanistan.
The affected area is bordering Pakistan. So a lot of returnees are also settled there as well.
These families were living in already precarious conditions, she says, some having to return to Afghanistan for the first time in years.
We must remember that winter is coming, and winter is quite harsh and for returnees, but also now earthquake-affected population.
India, the United Arab Emirates, and Iran have offered help. Aid workers tell me unless this help arrives fast, the death toll will continue to rise. Afghanistan has been hit with other deadly earthquakes in recent years. Floods are common, and parts of the country face droughts. Obaidullah Bahir in Kabul reflects on the many challenges his country faces.
I mean, I keep asking as to how many pieces can a heart break into, and those moments make you question that.
With global warming on the rise, he says, it seems like the world develops and the people in places like Afghanistan pay the price. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
In the rough swells of the North Sea off the Norwegian coast, engineers have made a lucrative new discovery, what's being called one of the largest oil deposits identified in Norway in a decade. It's one of several discovered in Norway's slice of the North Sea just this summer. Many experts had thought extraction in the North Sea would be slowly winding down soon. Professor Espen Moe is an expert in the politics of Norwegian oil at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. He says the discovery is significant.
It's sort of been the position of the most important political parties in Norway that we basically let the markets do what the markets do in the North Sea. We were in a phase where we weren't supposed to be investing extremely heavily in new oil extraction, and then this sort of breathed new life into everything. I mean, it's not as big as the ones that we had in the 1970s and the 80s and even in the 90s. But it sort of fits with both the Labour Party strategy and the Conservative strategy that will continue to develop, but not really open up any major new areas.
Oil is very important to Norway's economy, right?
Yes. that's safe to say. When the oil price was at its highest, it would account for almost 50% of exports and almost 20% of GDP. Although it is also true that we've become more of a natural gas economy than an oil economy over the past 10 years. So we have a harder time keeping up our oil extraction than we have our natural gas extraction. And also in terms of foreign politics, right? Ever since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there's an external pressure on Norway not to phase out our fossil fuel production, but to increase our gas production as much as possible so that we can be the reliable supplier for the European markets.
So is there domestic pushback around the kind of new exploration for oil that brought about these recent discoveries?
So we have a bit of a schizophrenous country in that respect, I would say. 4 years ago, I would say, the parliamentary elections 4 years ago, there was a huge discussion about whether or not there should be like a phase out, a controlled phase out of oil production and gas production. And there was a clear divide between, let's call them the adult or the establishment political parties who would tell you that this is the foundation of Norwegian wealth. And if you want to believe in rainbows and unicorns, that's fine, but that's not gonna put food on your table. And
the Green Party keep funding Norway's generous welfare state, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the Green Parties, and we have a sizable number of Green Parties who definitely wanted a controlled phase out. But then obviously only a year later, or less than a year, half a year later, Russia invaded Ukraine, and that turned pretty much everything on its head, not just with respect to what I just said about Europe now wanting more Norwegian gas, but also it made gas prices rise. When gas prices rose, that made renewables relatively more expensive. And so it's sort of changed the balance, the competitive balance between fossil fuels and what was a nascent Norwegian offshore wind power sector, which is now not as competitive or attractive as it used to be.
And does that shift in public opinion remain? You know, it's been years since that invasion started. Has that change proved to be lasting?
It has been pretty lasting. So wind power was already a slightly tricky proposition on the Norwegian mainland. It's not as if Norway has a lot of wind power. We have less than 6 gigawatts, and we're not a particularly densely populated country. So you would think that we had the areas necessary to stomach that kind of that amount of wind power. But wind power rapidly became the most polarizing, politically toxic topic of Norwegian, basically the general Norwegian political discourse, especially when it came to climate and energy.
So why did wind power become so polarizing in Norway?
I think there are basically two reasons. One reason is that Norwegians love nature. And for cost competitiveness, cost effectiveness reasons, we ended up with wind power in areas that were extremely scenic. And for people, we basically ruin large tracts of pristine nature. The other main reason is this perception that Norwegian wind power is installed not for the interests of the Norwegian people, but for renewable electricity to be exported to the European mainland, mainly Germany. So there's this trope that the Germans have taken our power, the Germans have taken our electricity.
You know, Norway is seen as a very green country. It has pledged to tackle its own greenhouse gas emissions in line with the global UN climate agreement. Norway's major oil company is state-owned. How does the government square these two things? You know, like saying we're going to reduce our emissions, but we are going to keep drilling oil and gas.
Well, this is a big question. This is a tricky one. I mean, we have this structural problem that we are not going to touch the petroleum sector. It will exist for as long as there is demand for petroleum. The big issue is really to what extent should we continue investing in it, but international markets will determine basically when there's an end in sight for the Norwegian extraction of oil and natural gas. And then we try to fix the obvious climate problem by doing other things like emissions-free cars and buying climate quotas from other countries, which is also politically touchy subjects, because a number of people think that this is basically Norway selling out and not taking its responsibility seriously.
You said that oil production in Norway was kind of expected to slowly wind down as dictated by markets. Do these discoveries this summer change that trajectory in your mind?
I think that Putin basically has given the Norwegian government a bit of a pass, in the sense that no one really objects heavily anymore if we keep investing in our petroleum sector. So for energy security reasons and energy sovereignty reasons, these are just resources that are too important to just shut down. And this new find is big and impressive, et cetera, et cetera. So it will not breathe a century of life into Norwegian oil extraction, but it will easily add a decade to high extraction and high production.
That seems significant.
That is significant. So I think most politicians in the biggest political parties, so that would be the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, the Centre Party, the Progress Party, are happy not to make any high-minded moral gestures with respect to the North Sea and just close their eyes and say yes, and we're happy to accept whatever new oil wells can be opened up in the near future.
Espen Moe is a professor at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. In Mexico, a shocking number of people go missing every year. Many of the victims are murdered and their bodies buried in hidden graves. A network of grassroots organizations is demanding that authorities do more about disappearances. In the meantime, they're taking the initiative to go out looking for their loved ones themselves. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Over the weekend, thousands of people all across Mexico went on the march to demand authorities do something about the crisis of disappearances. Close to 130,000 people are officially listed as missing in Mexico. In recent years, hundreds of hidden graves have been discovered. But identifying those bodies is a monumental task. And with the limited government response, many families have decided to search on their own. The world's Tibisay Isaiah traveled to the state of Sinaloa, the heart of drug cartel violence, to join a search operation.
It feels like a road trip. 12 women packed into a van, sharing snacks, chatting, making jokes to pass the time. But behind the small talk, they are all carrying the same kind of pain. Each one of them is looking for someone who never came home.
María Isabel Cruz Bernal. Soy presidenta fundadora.
María Isabel Cruz Bernal founded the collective Sabuesos Guerreras, or Warrior Bloodhounds, after her son, Josimar Garcia, disappeared. He was a young police officer in Culiacán working to fight organized crime. One day in 2017, two men came to pick him up, and he was never seen again. He was 22.
Entonces, desde ahí, pues, mi lucha ha sido buscar y encontrar a Yosimar.
Since then, her life has been dedicated to finding him and helping others do the same. They have found hundreds of hidden graves and body remains of missing people.
Con todos esos pedacitos, voy formando a Yosimar.
And with all those little pieces, she says, I'm putting my son Yosimar back together. The collective receives anonymous tips via phone or social media, and almost every week they go out to search. That day, they were following a lead about a possible grave outside Culiacán. It's dangerous. Sinaloa is in the middle of a cartel war. Criminal groups often hide bodies in clandestine graves, and they don't want anyone digging on their land.
Bueno, nosotros hemos recibido amenazas constantes. Hemos sido agredidas también.
Belinda Aguilar, another mother, says they have received death threats and were attacked once during a search. So to stay safe, this time they are escorted by 10 armed soldiers. The van pulls into an abandoned cornfield. Belinda Aguilar hands out radios. It's a very hot day. The women wear T-shirts printed with photos of their missing children. They grab shovels, gloves, sensors, and go out to search. The ground is dry and uneven. They move slowly, checking the soil with metal rods, feeling for soft spots that could lead to something. Cruz Bernal shouts to the missing. Guys, where are you? After a few minutes, someone finds bullets, several from different weapons. Then another woman points to what looks like blood on the soil. They have seen this kind of evidence before. Sometimes it leads to a body, sometimes it doesn't. These women aren't forensic experts, but over the years, they have learned to do the work. It's not something we are proud of, says Aguilar, but we do it because no one else does. There are hundreds of search collectives like this across Mexico, and they pay for their own training.
De antropología, de arqueología, fotografía.
On anthropology, archaeology, photography, forensic science. Cruz Bernal used to be a hairdresser. Now she's studying criminal law. By the end of the day, they haven't found any remains. So they mark the site and leave, exhausted, physically and emotionally. In 2018, Mexico launched the first national registry of the disappeared. It now has nearly 130,000 names. Most are young men, many are recruited by cartel members or killed for resisting. But women and girls are often taken too, sometimes forced into sexual exploitation. The crisis grew after 2006 when then-president Felipe Calderón launched a military war on drug cartels. Mexico started seeing crimes it never saw before, including deadly extortions, torture, and gruesome killings. But disappearance can be the cruelest of all, says Vianey Arce Sandoval, another searching mother.
Es una agonía, es como una enfermedad que te va consumiendo.
It's like an illness, one that slowly consumes you, she says. It deprives families of a body to mourn, of answers, and the simple certainty of death, she says. She eventually found her son's body, and that brought only a different kind of pain.
Pues viene otro tipo de dolor.
Now she wants justice, but she says she doesn't hold much hope. Because in Mexico, about 98% of crimes go unsolved. Carla Quintana is the former head of Mexico's National Commission for the Search of the Disappeared.
There was a lack of human and financial resources at state and federal level to respond to the crisis. We didn't have enough, and still we don't have enough, anthropologists, archaeologists, criminologists. The relatives were searching on their own.
Quintana says the Mexican government is overwhelmed with about 50,000 unidentified bodies in morgues across the country. To help address the crisis, the UN Population Fund is now working with the Mexican government to improve identification efforts. Maximilian Merck is heading the collaboration.
We support the implementation of a nationwide fingerprint system to match fingerprints for human identification purposes.
They've started comparing morgue records with national voter ID databases and even some from neighboring countries, something they weren't doing before. Last year, the project helped confirm over 6,500 identities. Still, the number of missing keeps growing faster than the number identified. Merck says the goal is ambitious: to match every one of the 50,000 unidentified remains with a name. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isea, Culiacán, Mexico.
We have more coverage of this important story on our YouTube channel. There you can find TB's firsthand account of reporting on mothers searching for the missing in Mexico, along with other challenges women still face in the country. Find us on YouTube at The World News GBH. We've got plenty more global stories coming at you. You are with The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A fleet of nearly two dozen ships left Barcelona yesterday. They and their passengers from 44 different countries are bound for the Gaza Strip. The flotilla's mission is to get through Israel's blockade to deliver humanitarian aid directly to Palestinians in Gaza. International aid organizations say that famine is widespread there. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
Crews spent the weekend loading their ships with supplies. Make way, a woman yells, watch your feet. She's steering a wooden dolly along the pier, piled with boxes of dry food, baby supplies, medicine. While they're stocking up, activists on a nearby stage stoke a crowd of thousands of supporters. Many wear traditional Palestinian scarves called kafia and wave Palestinian flags.
They cannot stop us because they're afraid of you!
The flotilla is made up of small pleasure craft, motor and sail. Hardly a match for Israeli warships. The Israeli government has diverted past attempts at getting to Gaza well before they got in view of the coast, sometimes firing water cannons at the boats.
You know, I'm not scared. I feel so compelled that if this doesn't stop now, it will only get worse.
Paul Reed stands in front of the boat he'll sail on. The bearded, barefoot young activist has come from Portland, Oregon to join the trip.
Many in the Western world, they look at attack helicopters and nuclear missiles and munitions as power, but that is not the only power in the world. We also have soft power, we have the power of the people.
And on this trip, the power of celebrity.
This story is not at all about the mission that we are about to embark.
Joining the flotilla is the young Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, known most for her warnings about climate change. She spoke to reporters in Barcelona prior to departure.
The story here is about Palestine. The story here is how people are being deliberately deprived of the very basic means to survive.
The supplies on these ships will hardly cover those needs, but as one onlooking supporter puts it,
I think this is not a symbolic gesture.
His name is Omar. He won't give his last name. He carries a hand-drawn Free Palestine sign.
If there's a doorknob on a door, only one hand can open it. So this is basically that hand that's opening the doorknob, and then everyone else will come in bringing the aid.
Aid that's waiting just outside Gaza in Egypt, out of reach to millions of displaced, starving Palestinians. Humanitarian boats have tried to breach the Israeli line before and failed. Israel calls them propaganda stunts that aid Hamas. It arrested and deported the crew on an attempt in June. Among the activists was Thunberg. Another supporter in the crowd, who only gives his name as Wally, says this will be a victory even if they don't break through.
Ultimately, a message is sent out to the world that this is not okay, that people are meant to live as human beings and not to have their basic human rights removed from them by having bombs dropped on them every single day.
The Barcelona flotilla first left Sunday but was forced back to port because of storms. If sailing is smooth from here on out, it should reach Gaza within a couple of weeks. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Across the U.S. and many other countries in the Western Hemisphere, it is back to school season. That means a fresh start with new routines and crowded classrooms and hallways where germs can spread. Making matters worse, this year, childhood vaccination rates are on the decline in lots of places. In Britain, for example, nearly one in five children starting primary school this year is not fully vaccinated against several serious diseases. That is according to the U.K. Health Security Agency. To learn more about this, we reached out to Helen Bedford. She's a professor of children's health at University College London. Helen, how did this year's vaccination rates compare to previous years in the UK?
Well, what we've seen in the UK over about the last 12 to 13 years is year on year, a very small decline, less than 1%. But obviously, over 12 years, that mounts up. And this year, we've seen a similar decline, or some of the vaccines have gone up a little bit. But the general direction is, unfortunately, downwards.
Why?
Well, there are many reasons. It's quite complicated. What we see, the average across the country overall is about 90%. That's for the what we might call the most basic vaccines, so diphtheria, tetanus, polio, etc.
Okay.
So overall, uptake rates are high. But of course, this is just an average. And that means there'll be areas in the country which are much lower than this. And what we see is much poorer uptake in inner cities, particularly London, where I'm sitting now. There will be pockets of very low uptake. And the reason for this is that in some parts of London, there's a lot of poverty and disadvantage, a lot of population mobility, and quite diverse populations with lots of different ethnic groups and cultural beliefs. And all these things can kind of add up, really, to make it difficult for some families to access vaccination. So they may not understand where to go to get their children vaccinated, or because of language difficulties, the information that's provided may not be understand. They may not understand it. But also, as well as all that, we have seen a lot of austerity over recent years with cuts to public health expenditure. So there's a particular health professional in the UK known as a health visitor. These are public health nurses who visit all families. It's a universal offer with a new baby. And unfortunately, their numbers have been cut by something like 40% since 2015. And it's those kind of things that can really become a challenge for families, because they are the person that you develop a trusting relationship with and can ask questions about vaccination if you're unsure.
So it sounds like that is the change in the past decade or so. I assume that, you know, London has been a diverse place with different income levels for a long time, but it sounds like that might be behind this recent change. Is that a fair assessment?
One of the reasons, yes. Obviously, there's pressure on general practice generally. So these are the doctors, general practice doctors. There's a lot of pressure there in terms of making appointments, getting to appointments, those sorts of things as well. So it's a combination of factors. But on top of that, of course, like everywhere else in the world, we've had the pandemic. And what we've seen as a result of that is that people have more questions about vaccination, which I think is a very good thing. But it's only good if you can get an opportunity to discuss those with somebody that you trust and, you know, can answer your questions. And in the absence of that, people tend to go to the internet, where, of course, we know there's an awful lot of misinformation.
Right. So is the UK seeing an increased risk of preventable diseases among children because of this decrease in vaccination uptake?
Well, last year we had the highest number of measles cases, almost 3,000 that we've had for over a decade.
Wow.
And unfortunately, earlier this year, a child died from measles. And in terms of other infectious diseases, we've seen big outbreaks of whooping cough. So last year, again, big outbreak of whooping cough. And it's just been reported very recently that a baby has died of whooping cough.
Yeah.
Now, that, of course, is about maternal vaccination. And we've seen similar declines in uptake of maternal vaccines as well as the childhood program.
What are health officials in the UK trying to do to reverse this trend?
Well, what we're trying to do is encourage parents, if you've got questions, to turn to a health professional to ask those questions. But also we need to be doing more in terms of making sure that parents are aware of the schedule, how to get the vaccines, when the vaccines are due. And as children are going back to school now or starting school for the first time, there are promotional campaigns to encourage parents to have their children vaccinated. There's also going to be a government campaign about misinformation on the internet and how to avoid it, or how to look at it critically.
I'm curious, where do you see the trends going? I mean, vaccination rates have dropped in the somewhat recent past and eventually rebounded. Do you see that happening again here?
Well, I think I choose to be optimistic about this. I think, you know, we can come back. I think one of the problems vaccination has, which often isn't addressed fully, is that if you have a successful vaccination program, which we have had, and the diseases go away, people forget about them. And it's actually quite challenging to talk to a young parent about a particular infection and how nasty it can be, because we're so used to our children now not catching anything remotely serious because of vaccination, that it's hard for young parents maybe to even sort of imagine, you know, a disease like measles at its worst.
In some ways, it sounds like the vaccination has been kind of a victim of its own success.
Well, that's what's often said, yes. And unfortunately, sometimes it takes outbreaks for people to be reminded just how serious these diseases are. And so it's quite a challenge, but I think, you know, we can overcome it. But we need to learn more about how to communicate the severity of infections that you're not seeing on a daily basis or perhaps ever, so that people continue to vaccinate.
Helen Bedford is a professor of children's health at University College London. She's been speaking with us about the decline of childhood vaccine uptake in the UK. Everybody needs to find their people, a group of friends or a social scene where you just feel comfortable expressing yourself. Earlier this year, the world's Matthew Bell visited an open mic event in New York. It's a place where Chinese language speakers have created their own world of comedy, political activism, and therapy.
It's not easy to get a ticket. As soon as a new date is announced, these open mic events sell out right away. They take place at different venues around New York City. This one's in the auditorium of a grade school on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And they're organized by a group called Nuzza Jiyi.
So if you translate it literally, it means feminism.
That's producer Vicky Wong, who worked on this story with me, and we're talking during the intermission. Vicky is a Chinese-speaking stand-up comic herself, who's also performed at one of the open mic events organized by Nuzza Jiyi.
However, they swapped out one of the characters, so instead of ism, it means ideas. So it's women's ideas rather than straightforward feminism, but the pronunciation is the same.
The audience is mostly women in their 20s and 30s from across the Chinese-speaking world, Hong Kong, Taiwan, mainland China. The theme of today's show is behind closed doors, and it includes a fun interactive component with those in attendance, as Vicky explains.
All the performers are sharing secrets that they're keeping for their family, in their family, and during intermission, they're sharing this QR code so that audience members can scan it and then share a secret that they no longer want to keep anonymously with the whole room.
And the word Mimi, I just learned, is secret in Chinese. And the people that were on stage for the first part of the show kept coming back to this theme of secrets. And what were they sharing?
A lot of them are talking about being in the closet and coming out with their family, whether that's because of their sexual orientation or one woman shared that she's in a non-monogamous relationship, which is also pretty unorthodox for China. One woman shared that she did artificial insemination and got pregnant with her lesbian partner, and her family flat out refused to admit that to any of their family and friends and claimed that she just got knocked up in America. Stories like that tend to be the kind of things that people come and share at Nuzza Jiyi shows.
Liang Xiaowen is sharing a story about the time state security agents came to visit when she still lived in China. She said her parents worried the men were there to question her dad. But then her mom said to Liang, with some relief, "Oh, the security people are here for you." Liang tells me on Zoom the incident was from 10 years ago, and it took a long time to get to the point where she could laugh about it.
I was like super scared when that happened. It affected me and my family. Because can you imagine, like, your dad just called you and you were a closeted lesbian. Your dad called you saying that, like, the police were there talking about, like, your activism work. So that scared the shit out of me.
The authorities in China know how to intimidate people, Liang tells me. She says she can't imagine sharing a story like this publicly back home in China, where freedom of expression is limited. But the open mic provides an opportunity to do so.
We have a stage that's designed for us. By us, I mean Chinese-speaking women, queer, marginalized people who speak both, you know, Chinese and English, and who are still deeply connected with what's going on back home in China.
Liang helps organize Nutsujuyi events, and like pretty much everyone who participates, she uses a stage name when she performs. There are also some pretty strict rules, as another organizer explains to me. She goes by the stage name 997 and says she doesn't want her picture taken.
No camera, no recording.
And why is that?
It's just because we talk a lot about, we talk a lot of like sensitive issue that will definitely get censored, like in Chinese word. That's why we ask, like, no confidential, everything happens here stays here.
Another performer who goes by the initials LP says she has mixed feelings about not identifying herself.
I kind of feel like it's a little bit sad for me to not using my real name, to be honest. But if like people connect your face and your name, there could be potential risk that they can find your family back in China, and we all have people that we care about.
The humor and commentary here gets a little salty at times. There's stuff about sex, sexuality, along with lots of jokes about the news, family, and relationships. And this is a reminder of what the Chinese open mic is all about. Wang Yaqiu is a fellow with the University of Chicago's Forum for Free Inquiry and Expression.
I think, first of all, it's fun. It's entertainment. That's, you know, why it attracts a lot of people. I'm a researcher for women's rights issue in China for over a decade. The topic is depressing, but I think this open mic is just, first of all, you know, it's comedy. So I think that's, to me, this is probably is the most important character.
Similar Chinese language open mic events are happening in other U.S. cities, Washington and Los Angeles. Wang says they've been around for a few years and seem to be getting more popular. A new concern, she says, is the political atmosphere here in this country for visa holders and undocumented immigrants under the Trump administration.
You know, if you're not a citizen, you're not even a green card holder, like you wonder whether if I make a joke about Trump, even in a bar, in a club, would that affect my visa status? Would my visa be revoked?
Wang says this all makes her worry. But as one stand-up performer told me, if anyone knows how to handle a repressive political environment with courage and good humor, it's members of the feminist community from China. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, New York.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Things were quiet today in Jakarta, but for more than a week, anti-government protests in the Indonesian capital and other cities have spun out of control. Several people have died, hundreds more injured. Buildings have been torched, and police have set up checkpoints across the city. The demonstration started after Indonesian lawmakers decided to give themselves new perks and benefits. Sydney Jones is a longtime expert on Indonesian affairs who is now teaching at New York University.
I think you have to see this as the explosion of long simmering grievances over the last decade by the urban poor, students, workers, and NGOs who have watched as the elite, the political elite, have made themselves richer and richer. There were specific triggers, but that's the underlying problem.
And what were the specific triggers? It was perks for lawmakers?
Yes. Yeah, so on the 24th of August, the legislators basically gave themselves housing perks, which gave them a monthly allowance that was about 10 times the minimum wage of the average worker in Jakarta. And then on the 28th, there was a labor protest by workers and unions, and it ended in the police running over a motorcycle taxi driver. And that's what spurred the explosion across the country.
So since then, on Sunday, President Prabowo Subianto announced some concessions. He said the government would reverse some of the perks for lawmakers. Has that calmed things down at all?
No, not really. He basically reversed or revoked the perks, and he also forbade the legislators from going overseas on foreign study tours, which are usually shopping trips. But those are two minor band-aids in a set of grievances which is so much bigger than this and represents in many ways the erosion of democratic reforms in Indonesia.
So how much does the public blame President Prabowo specifically for the problems that are driving people to protest?
Well, he's only been president for about a year, but he comes from a military background, and that has been one factor in the suspicions and the accumulation of grievances against him. But the real problem lies with his predecessor, Jokowi, whose real name is Joko Widodo. He's the person who supervised the erosion of democracy in Indonesia and in some ways the widening of this gap between the elite and the rest of Indonesia.
And what are the protesters asking for now?
Well, this is part of the problem, especially if you compare it with 1998 when Suharto fell. There was a clear goal, which was the overthrow of Suharto. Now it's much more diffuse. They want police reform and more police accountability. They want an overhaul of the legislative system and of the national parliament more generally. Very hard to translate that into specific achievable goals.
Sydney, you lived in this country for 20 years. You just mentioned these protests back in the 90s. Do you see this level of public outcry as unusual or unusual in recent years?
Yes, this is the biggest outpouring of anger since 1998. And at that time, we had the Asian financial crisis. This time, it's more general economic malaise. You can't point to one single factor, except that this president undertook an efficiency campaign, much like DOGE in the United States, of slashing government agencies and in a way that translated into injustices for those at the bottom of the income scale. So in that sense, there are parallels with 1998, but this is unprecedented in the last two decades.
Based on your knowledge of, you know, how protests work and what they accomplish in Indonesia, are there things that you'll be looking for going forward to see if any change might come about because of these people taking to the streets?
Well, one thing that the students in particular are very concerned about is that if it doesn't stay calm, that Prabowo as a former general might impose martial law. I think that's probably unlikely, but I would be looking for the possible sacking of the national police chief. That also will be a band-aid. It won't do anything for police reform more generally. And I would be looking for an articulation of more specific reforms that this grassroots movement could promote.
Sydney Jones is a longtime expert on Indonesian affairs who's now teaching at New York University. Concert listings do not typically include notes about bed assignments, but Max Richter's Sleep is an all-night affair, so the warning to audience members not to switch beds during an upcoming performance in London actually makes sense. The music is based on the neuroscience of sleep. Richter's 8.5-hour composition was written to be enjoyed by a dozing audience. It was first released in 2015. Shows in Paris, Berlin, Sydney, and beyond were enormously popular. The original idea came from a conversation Richter had with his partner, Julia, as he recently explained to the CBC.
I was touring a fair bit and, you know, Julia would often be listening in a different time zone in the middle of the night or whatever. And she had this experience of like being in this sort of boundary state, half awake, half asleep.
And in that kind of state, you hear things differently.
Your executive bit of your brain is sort of away and you just sort of receive this sort of material in a more direct way.
Richter says he got to thinking about actually composing music for an audience that's drifting off to dreamland.
The piece works a lot on subsonics. You know, it's got a lot of low end in it.
A lot of those low notes are borderline inaudible. This has an impact on the listener, especially a listener in a cozy bed. One early performance of Sleep in China was at a heavily guarded venue surrounded by soldiers. And Richter says that at one point he got up to walk around behind the stage while the strings were playing.
And I see all these soldiers with their guns asleep on the floor. And I was just like, yeah.
The performance this week in London marks the 10th anniversary of Sleep by Max Richter. And remember, you can't switch beds, so choose wisely. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime and on YouTube or at The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Buehler. Thank you for listening and join us back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Dodie and Billy Crockett, Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser, and Lynn and Bruce Dayton. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.